Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Viva Energy Australia full year 2019 results announcement. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Scott Wyatt, Chief Executive Officer. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and welcome to the Viva Energy results presentation for the full year ending December 2019. My name is Scott Wyatt. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Viva Energy, and with me today is Jevan Bouzo, our Chief Financial Officer. Today's results presentation follows our announcement last week that we sold our 35.5% interest in Viva Energy REIT for 734 million dollars. The divestment was an important transaction for Viva Energy and its shareholders, as it allows us to unlock capital and return this to shareholders through a proposed buyback of shares. We'll spend some time discussing this in more detail later in the call, but let me begin with an overview of our 2019 results commencing on slide four of the presentation pack. During the course of last year, we maintained a strong safety and environmental performance and progressed a number of new programs which helped sustain a strong safety culture. I'm particularly pleased that 95% of our employees surveyed felt that their team is committed to operating safely and empowered to intervene and raise any safety concerns. Like all Australians, we've been shocked by the devastating bushfires impacting many parts of the country. As you would expect, we were involved in delivering fuel to impacted areas to support firefighting efforts and have also assisted with donations to organizations who are directly supporting recovery. In line with our standard practice, we have provided paid leave to all our employees that have volunteered to help respond to these fires. Last year, we also formalized our Indigenous Participation Program and launched our inaugural Reconciliation Action Plan that was endorsed by Reconciliation Australia. This plan celebrates Indigenous cultures, promotes reconciliation, builds respect, and raises cultural awareness. We also continue to support a range of community programs right across the country. Within the company itself, we continue to foster inclusiveness and diversity. Our support for part-time operator positions at Geelong Refinery is helping to attract more women to our frontline operations, and our involvement with Career Tracker Internship Program provides career and leadership development for Indigenous students. We are recognized as an employer of choice for gender equality, and our employee engagement scores stand at 68%, with many employee groups at top quartile. Turning to our scorecard on slide five, let me just say a few words about our overall operating and financial performance. Over the last year, we've seen several changes which have altered the industry landscape. Changes in the ownership of competitor fuel and convenience businesses and the renegotiation of our retail alliance arrangements were material developments in the retail market. While the global transition to lower sulfur marine fuels and more generally changes in crude flows as a result of regional conflict and trade barriers have led to periods of volatility in both oil prices and refining margins. In the context of these external developments, I'm very pleased with the underlying performance of the business and the progress made on our strategic priorities. Total sales volumes were up nearly 5% on 2018 as a result of substantially improved performance in our retail alliance business, continued growth in our Liberty channels, and solid sales across our commercial and wholesale sectors. Refining was also strong with periods of record production, high levels of unit availability and utilization, and a focus on optimization to minimize exposure to lower margin production. Our decision to take responsibility for retail fuel pricing across the alliance network has delivered steady improvements in sales performance and brand perception. We expect to continue this during 2020 as we maintain our price and value positioning in market. Lower retail market margins recovered in quarter four 2019, and we are now well placed to benefit from any sustained improvement in trading conditions through 2020. Several expiring commercial contracts were successfully renewed during the year, and we also expanded strategic relationships with key partners such as the Australian Defence Force, which provide opportunities for growth in the years ahead. We've maintained a strong capital discipline, with operating capital expenditure reducing by 33% to $162 million, and relatively low net debt of $137 million. Group underlying EBITDA was at the top end of our December 2019 guidance, and we've maintained a dividend payout of 60% of distributable net profit after tax. Following the sell down of our stake in Viva Energy REIT, we also intend to undertake a share buyback using all of the net after tax proceeds of $680 million. Slide 6 gives more detail on our sales and earnings performance. As I noted earlier, total sales volumes were up approximately 5% on prior year, but also well ahead of the broader market, which marginally declined by 1%. This outperformance was driven by stronger sales in both retail and commercial sectors. Petrol sales stabilised following the restoration and growth of the Retail Alliance, while sales of diesel and jet were up 10% and 4% respectively, as a result of strong performance in our aviation, liberty and wholesale sectors. Premium fuels remain steady at 28% of total petrol sold, and we see opportunities to improve this over time as we build customer brand preference and grow sales through the Alliance channel. Notwithstanding this strong sales performance, earnings in our non-refining segments fell about 19% on prior year, contributing $528 million towards the underlying group EBITDA of $645 million, and with refining contributing $117 million. This decline in earnings was predominantly impacted by several market headwinds, which also had a considerable impact on overall industry profitability last year. Let me comment on these just by turning to slide 7. As mentioned earlier, lower retail fuel margins were driven by softer retail market conditions, changes in competitive dynamics, and periods of rising oil prices. This was a challenging period for the industry, so it was pleasing to see margins strengthen and stabilise in quarter four, and this has continued into 2020, supported by falling oil prices. Regional refining margins were generally weak on the back of continued lower regional demand growth, and more recently due to rising crude premiums as the industry transitions to lower sulphur marine fuels. Coupled with weaker than expected demand for marine diesel fuel, regional diesel refining cracks have been relatively disappointing, and this continues to put pressure on Geelong refining margins together with regional demand impacts from coronavirus. While cost increases are generally recovered in all our retail and commercial contracts, a lower dollar and higher ocean freight during 2019 have particularly impacted commercial earnings. We expect to see some recovery as we progressively pass through cost increases over time, and we continue to work on initiatives to improve efficiency and reduce energy costs more generally across our business. Slide 8 sets out the impact of these market-driven factors on our 2019 earnings compared with the prior year. Lower retail and commercial market margins, higher ocean freight, a lower Australian dollar and weaker regional refining margins collectively reduced earnings by approximately $137 million, with lower retail market margins accounting for nearly two-thirds of this impact. As mentioned earlier, retail margins stabilised and strengthened in the fourth quarter and have continued to hold through early 2020. We are less than 2 months into the year, but should this environment prevail, then this should be supportive of improved earnings in our retail business. Moving to factors which are more directly within the company's control, you can see that the changes to the Alliance agreement with Coles resulted in a margin uplift of just over $100 million during 2019. Since we took control of retail fuel pricing in March, we have repositioned fuel prices in line with our major competitors, which is estimated to have cost $66 million. Should market margins fully recover, then the net benefit of these changes is therefore around $37 million last year. Resulting sales growth in 2019 added $9 million across both retail and commercial earnings, and we expect this to continue as we restore sales in the Alliance channel. Margin from improved refinery production was offset by cost increases and lower margin in our supply chain segment, while higher employee and corporate costs accounted for cost increases of $17 million. Overall, the underlying EBITDA from factors directly within the company's control contributed to improved earnings of around $30 million over 2018 in an underlying basis. Before I head over to Jevan to discuss our financial performance in more detail, I would just like to set out the key strategic achievements we delivered in 2019 as set out in slide 9. The renegotiation of the Alliance agreement and the full acquisition of the Liberty Wholesale business has allowed us to simplify and strengthen our retail operating platforms. We have the largest single-branded fuel and convenience network in the country, with over 700 sites operating under the Alliance and a value-led offering under development with Liberty Retail. Our new arrangements will help us better leverage these relationships and further develop our leading fuel and convenience offers in the years ahead. Although regional refining margins have been disappointing, we have greatly improved our operating performance at Geelong, which has helped to maximise production and make the most of the margin opportunity. I believe that we are very well placed to benefit from any improvements in regional refining margins in the months ahead. Finally, I'm pleased with the way we've maintained a strong capital discipline. In preparation for the major maintenance turnaround of our refinery this year, we reduced capital spend by 33% during 2019, and our net debt remains low. As announced to the ASX on Friday, we sold our non-core shareholding in Viva Energy REIT for $734 million, which allows us to return capital to shareholders. This is consistent with our objectives to maintain a flexible balance sheet to allow for investment and growth while maximising returns to shareholders. I'll now hand over to Jevan Bouzo, Chief Financial Officer, who will discuss the financial results in more detail.
Thanks, Scott. Slide 11 summarises our financial results for 2019 in the format you're used to seeing. Rather than talk to this slide, I'll go through each area in a bit more detail, starting with retail on slide 12. Retail underlying EBITDA RC for the year was 7% below 2018 at $564 million, but above the guidance provided in December 2019 as a result of retail market conditions improving beyond our forecast into the end of the year. The chart at the bottom left of the slide sets out the key changes from 2018 to 2019, and there were really two major impacts during the year. The first was resetting the Alliance Agreement, which on historical margins provided a direct earnings uplift of $103 million. During the year, about $66 million was spent lowering retail fuel prices in line with our competitors and driving marketing programs to re-engage customers. This worked well, with sales volumes through the Alliance lifting to 65 million litres per week in the second half. The second major impact was retail market margins falling during 2019, due to periods of higher oil prices and then heightened competition. This impacted earnings by approximately $86 million, and I'll touch on this a little bit more on the next slide. Data from the Australian Institute of Petroleum on slide 13 is based on national simple average data and can be used as a directional guide for actual market margins. From the chart, you can see margins in 2019 have declined to their lowest level in 5 years, as prolonged periods of higher oil prices and then later heightened competition impacted the year. From the bars on the right, you can see that retail margins improved in the fourth quarter, more in line with recent historical levels, and we're continuing to see positive results in the early part of 2020. Despite this short-term volatility, we remain confident in the long-term strength of the sector and our opportunity to outperform, given our ability to capture upside in retail margins under the reset alliance arrangements. Turning to slide 14, commercial earnings of $297 million were down 10% on the prior year. The bridge at the bottom left of the slide sets out the key impacts to the result from 2018 to 2019. You'll recall that 2018 was a particularly strong year for commercial, and while we saw some volume growth in 2019, a number of contract renewals returned lower margins, which have impacted results by about $13 million. In addition, there are some shorter-term contracts where certain price elements are fixed, with changes only able to be passed on from renewal to renewal. During the year, we saw a lot of volatility in ocean freight rates leading up to the IMO compliance date, and this impacted 2019 by about $18 million relative to the prior year. Despite some headwinds during 2019, including the lower Australian dollar, we maintain a high-quality customer portfolio and continue to see sales growth and acquisition of new strategic accounts, such as the Australian Defence Force that Scott mentioned earlier. Turning to slide 15, the refining segment delivered underlying EBITDA RC of $117 million, which is in line with the prior year and reflects continued weakness in regional refining margins, offset by strong operating performance for periods of the year. Several operational records were set at Geelong during the year, with white barrel production averaging 105,000 barrels per day, diesel production of 39%, and refinery intake of 42 million barrels, delivering about $17 million of earnings compared with 2018. While the falling Australian dollar delivered a $29 million benefit, the GRM of $6.60 per barrel compared with $7.40 in 2018 reduced earnings by $45 million. Cost increases were partially offset by energy benefits realised through the power purchase agreement with the Mount Gellibrand Wind Farm for approximately one-third of Geelong's electricity requirements. As you can see on slide 16, gasoline cracks were lower than the long-term average during 2019, largely due to lower regional oil demand growth, exports from China, and additional production from refineries that upgraded their production of light products ahead of IMO 2020. Diesel cracks remained strong as expected, but were offset by increasing crude premiums towards the end of the year as refineries shifted to a sweeter diet in preparation for lower sulphur marine fuels. High sulphur fuel oil cracks have declined sharply as expected, but these have minimal impact on GRM for Geelong as we produce fuel oil from imported blend stock. While not shown on the chart and given short history, low sulphur fuel oil cracks have started strong, tracking broadly in line with diesel cracks. The IMO 2020 transition continues to be the primary driver of refining margins during early 2020, with the impacts from coronavirus on regional demand a watch point. Turning to our supply, corporate and overhead segments on slide 17, we delivered an underlying EBITDA of minus $333 million. The bridge on the bottom left sets out the key drivers of change from the prior year. Supply chain impacts of $8 million were due to increased coastal shipping and property management costs. Salaries and wages and corporate costs combined contributed an extra $16 million and were primarily driven by natural and contracted wage inflation and the full year impact of being a publicly listed company. In 2019, there were some one-off costs of about $8 million. These mostly related to transaction activity, and there were also about $13 million of one-off benefits in 2018, which did not repeat. Slide 18 outlines our capital expenditure. Total operating capex for the year was $161 million, excluding the payments for Coles Express and the Liberty acquisition. This compares with operating capex of $241 million in 2018. And is reflective of a focus on tighter capital allocation in what has been a challenging market environment during 2019. Our forecast capex for 2020, excluding the planned turnaround activities, is between $140 to $160 million, reflecting continued discipline in this space. The board has approved the major maintenance turnaround of the residual catalytic cracking unit and associated processing units during 2020. The estimated capital cost is between $110 and $140 million. This activity is scheduled to begin towards the end of the third quarter and was last undertaken in 2016. The turnaround is expected to negatively impact refining intake by approximately 1 to 1.5 million barrels and will also reduce GRM during the 5 to 8 week period of turnaround activity. The actual impact on GRM will depend on the regional refining margin environment at the time. We estimate the total capex for 2020 will be between $250 and $300 million. Slide 19 sets out the 2019 cash flow bridge. Underlying free cash flow is set out in the table at the top right of the slide. After adjusting for changes in working capital of $33 million, the payment to Coles and Liberty totaling $162 million, and net loans to associates of $4 million. Underlying free cash flow for the year was $189 million, out of which we paid dividends of $134 million. Under the new accounting standard, operating leases are now classified as finance costs and repayment of lease liability, rather than a component of EBITDA. Turning to slide 20 on the balance sheet, we've set out the change in net debt from 31 December 2018 to 31 December 2019. Strong cash generation and the focus on tightening capital expenditure has contributed to the company maintaining a relatively low level of net debt. The primary drivers of movement in net debt to $137 million at 31 December 2019 was the payment to Coles, the acquisition of Liberty and loans to associates, which combined totaled $158 million. Our lower net debt position, combined with the fact we recently extended our working capital facility of US $700 million through to 2022, means that the company retains maximum financial flexibility, which is not contingent on maintaining a credit rating. The S&P rating held by the company was secured when we brought Viva Energy REIT to market in 2016. Since this time, Viva Energy REIT have obtained their own rating, and in line with the sell-down of our stake last week, we've issued a notice to S&P to withdraw our rating. On slide 21, we set out the reconciliation of NPAT to underlying NPAT RC, and then distributable NPAT RC. There are a couple of minor significant items, which between them were a non-cash benefit of $4 million, alongside the impact of finalisation of the one-off tax consolidation benefit of $8.2 million. We've announced a final dividend for the second half of 2.6 cents per share, bringing our total dividend for 2019 to 4.7 cents per share, fully franked. This represents a 60% payout ratio of distributable NPAT RC and is consistent with the ratio applied at the half. We continue to adjust distributable NPAT RC for the new accounting standard AASB 16, which is an example of a non-cash impact to earnings. We've also maintained our policy to target a 50 to 70% payout ratio of distributable NPAT RC. Turning to slide 22, we announced last week that we sold the company's 35.5% stake in Viva Energy REIT for a total of $734.3 million and an estimated pre-tax profit on sale of $112.9 million. The company will, however, no longer receive cash distributions from VVR, nor record a share of profit from associates, which included non-cash investment property revaluations. The divestment was an important transaction for Viva Energy and our shareholders, and it releases a substantial portion of capital for the company to return to shareholders, recognising that investors who want exposure to VVR have the ability to invest directly on the ASX rather than indirectly through Viva Energy. In terms of timing, VVR has performed well since listing, and current market conditions provided an opportunity to exit at an attractive price. Over 400 of our retail sites continue to be leased from VVR, and we retain security of tenure through long-term leases with multiple option periods. We'll continue to have a number of ongoing relationships with Viva Energy REIT, including as manager of the vehicle, which remains unchanged. We'll work constructively with the independent directors in respect of future arrangements, and Lachlan Pfeiffer and I will remain on the board in the near term. In respect of the capital management program, our intention is to return all of the $680 million of after-tax proceeds from the divestment to shareholders by way of an off-market buyback, subject, of course, to obtaining regulatory and shareholder approvals. The off-market buyback is expected to be completed during the second quarter of this year, and any shortfall in the off-market program will be returned by an off-market and on-market buyback. I'll now hand back to Scott to wrap up.
Thanks, Jevan. I'll finish now with a few comments on the outlook for the business in the upcoming year, which is set out on slide 24. As mentioned earlier, we've established a strong foundation last year with much improved retail operating platform, strong operating performance and positive action on capital management. Our focus is on the year ahead is to build on this through continued improvement in our brand perception and sales growth in our core retail channels, optimisation of volume and margin mix across both retail and commercial, and continued focus on cost efficiency, especially within our supply chain. In our refining business, we aim to maintain production flexibility to optimise margins and to execute our major maintenance turnaround on time and within budget. We'll progress our share buyback, as Jevan has set out, and continue to maintain a strong focus on capital management. Given the various M&A activity in the market, we will continue to consider and assess any relevant opportunities. We will, however, take a cautious approach which carefully considers quality of earnings, overall value and strategy, and execution risk. We are focused on opportunities which leverage synergies and are accretive to shareholders. We're also closely watching development of coronavirus. At this point, there has not been any material short-term impact on our business. However, there may be longer-term impacts from lower regional demand and a general slowdown in economic activity. We are monitoring potential impacts to our business operations, procurement functions and customers, and we've taken steps to minimise any risk to our employees and contractors. Finally, I would like to acknowledge a number of changes to our executive leadership that will take effect from the end of March 2020. Daniel Ridgway, our Chief Operating Officer, has made a decision to leave the company after more than 22 years with the business. Daniel wishes to pursue new interests, and on behalf of the company, I want to thank him for his significant contribution over all those years, and especially in our time as Viva Energy. I'm very pleased to announce that Tase Haynes will succeed Daniel as our Chief Operating Officer, and welcome Dale Cooper to replace Tase as our Executive General Manager of Refining. Dale joins us from Canada and with more than 30 years' experience in the refining sector. I expect these changes in leadership will be smooth and that we'll maintain pace in pursuing our goals in 2020. This brings me to the end of the presentation. I'd like to now hand over the call to questions.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, you will need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star, then two. If you are on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Mark Sampa from MST. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. I don't really know how to ask a question on M&A that I'll get an answer to, but I guess maybe to think about, at least there's obviously a lot going on the sector at the moment, and there's potentially people who end up with assets that are very unnatural owners of those assets that could have strategic benefit to you. I guess I'll couch the question about M&A and with the credit rating going today in the context of all the Viva REIT stakes going to buyback. Can you talk through the capacity you think you have now that all of that money is going to be returned to shareholders?
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for the question. I might hand that over to Jevan to answer that question.
Hey, Mark. How are you going?
Good. Exactly.
In the context of your question, I think we've got a relatively low net debt position at $137 million. I mentioned on the balance sheet slide that we've recently extended our US $700 million facility through to 2022, which in Australian dollar terms gives a total facility limit of about $1 billion. So we've got quite a lot of capacity there under the existing facility. When we've talked about long-term debt levels in the past, we've tended to talk about something in the range of half to one times EBITDA being fairly sustainable for a business of our nature. And, I think if there was a very attractive opportunity, you could perhaps go a little bit above the top end of that range on a temporary basis to take advantage of something that you thought made sense. But, we'll still remain disciplined in that space.
Right. Thanks. And then just a question when we think about the buyback. I know you can't speak for Vittol and the desire to do otherwise, but is there a desire from Viva to maintain in percentage terms the Vittol stake at 45% or whatever it is? And I guess how we should then think about the fact that if, because there's no franking credits, if the other 55% of the register would effectively prefer it on market and therefore aren't wildly enticed to participate on the on market, is there a cap to how much you would do on market if there is a big residual after the off market?
Yeah, it's obviously hard for us to speak on behalf of others. I think what I would say to that question, Mark, is that there's $680 million of after-tax proceeds, gross proceeds were $734, so there are some franking credits that will be associated with the transaction. Our intention is to complete an off-market buyback, and I think we would like to see Vittol Investment Partnership participate on a proportionate basis. Say for them creeping over 50% to a control position. So at this stage, I'd be expecting them to participate proportionately to sit where they are. Beyond that, if there was any shortfall in the off-market buyback, our intention would be to return that by way of an on-market program.
Cool. Okay, perfect. And I might just sneak in one really quick question on resale margins if I can. Oil price aside, which obviously has helped through this process, can you get, I know everyone in this sector blames everyone else for prices going down and probably for prices going back up. Can you give us a flavour for what you think's driven the increase in margins beyond the oil price impact over the last, I guess, 3-4 months that we've seen?
Look, I think, Mark, as you sort of touched on, it's a lot of different factors at play that impact retail fuel margins. I think probably obviously last year we went through a few periods of very difficult times for retail market margins, including as a result of rising oil prices and just general changes in competitive activity. We saw retail margins strengthen in quarter four and stabilise, and that sort of continued through to 2020. Obviously, falling oil prices do provide some margin uplift temporarily as well. But I think generally it feels like, you know, it's much more stable and more, you know, consistent with what we've seen in the past. And as I sort of said through my introduction, that if those conditions continue through the course of 2020, then we should expect to see a better year from our retail business, which will obviously be a good thing.
Thank you. Your next question comes from David Errington from Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Morning, Scott. Morning, Jevan. Scott, I was really disappointed to hear that Dan's left the business. I mean, clearly, you know, I had a very high regard for Dan, but I also know he was very highly regarded. You know, he did a lot of good job with that. And I'm worried whether, because in your slide 12, you highlight market margin compression is a big cause for the retail margins having been hit, which is following on from Mark's question just before, which you call out as a non-controllable compression, but I'm not certain that that's completely right, because I think that, you know, you were a contributor to a bit of the compression when you took over the margin, and there was going to be a normal, if you like, competitor response to a large industry event. So given how important getting back that $86 million of market margin compression is to Viva going forward, I mean, that's a big, you know, factor in our investment thesis, that you can get back that compression that happened. I'm worried that losing people like Dan, whether you've got the capability in that retail team, that retail management team, to now, because you're now controlling the retail side of the business, whereas previously you didn't, you're really controlling the price. Can you give us some assurance that you're going to be on top of that? Because as I said, your 22 years experience has just walked out the door, and, you know, I was disappointed to hear that he's left the business.
No, sure. And thanks for the question, David. I mean, he hasn't left yet. He leaves at the end of March. But, and obviously I've worked with Dan for a very long time, both previously with Shell and then obviously more closely through the journey that we've been on as part of Viva Energy. And obviously a lot of the achievements that we've delivered in the last 5 years, Dan has been a big part of. But, you know, this just changes as a managed transition. Dan has a desire, as you can expect after a long period of time in the industry, to move on to other things. And he's worked closely with us to ensure that we manage this transition in a seamless way. Megan Foster came into the business to run the consumer business and take over from Dan at the beginning of last year. That's given us more than a year for her and Dan to work closely together as she gets up to speed with our industry. She has a very strong retail background and obviously can apply that to our industry, but in the time of last year that she's worked with Dan, she's been able to learn from him. And so he leaves the consumer business in a very strong place with her leading that part of the business. And obviously she joined at a great time because we were obviously embarking on our new journey in terms of controlling, setting fuel prices and delivering this, setting up the strategy for the future. So I think that's in a really strong place. And, you know, obviously we still have good continuity through the rest of the executive team. You know, Jevan, who you know very well, has been with us through the entire journey as well. He's as our chief financial officer, but he's much more than that and has a very strong understanding of the rest of the business and plays a key role in helping to drive the various different elements of that as well. So I feel like it's been a very, very carefully managed transition. I think it's sad to see Dan go, but I think we are well placed to continue to drive the momentum and the outcomes that you you touched on before that you were, you know, that everyone's looking for.
Well, following, and Mark was touching onto it, and this is where I suppose he was going, but what's the key variable in getting that $86 million? I keep on harping that $86 million because that's That's the prize now, to get that back. That's $86 million, which is a big chunk of your earnings. You know, you're talking a big, big chunk. What's the key driver that we have to be looking at to see how you can get that back? Is it just lower oil prices? Is it a competitor dropping out of the market? What will be the key driver to you getting that back? Because I must say, Megan, I know Megan worked at Myer for a long time, and she's an outstanding retailer. But you know, this is the petrol market now, and I'm just 22 years of experience of the petrol market has now walked out. You know, I've just lost a little bit of confidence, if you like, of you being able to get that $86 million back. So what's the key driver in getting it back?
Well, I think, you know, I said what you said earlier on, that, you know, the market factors, we are a part of the market, so we have some influence and impact in the outcome around market margins in terms of how we behave and how we price in market. So that slide wasn't really trying to set it out in a way that disconnects our responsibility from that, and I think we've done a lot to reposition ourselves in market to price sensibly and in a sophisticated way on a very local market level across the country. We've learnt a lot as we've taken over that responsibility. I think we're managing that well, and I'm sure that is also a significant part of the improvement in retail market margins that we saw starting to develop in quarter four and continue through to 2020. So, you know, I think we do, by being an active participant in market, by being more active in terms of how we price and being more competitive, we also have quite a degree of influence over how on market outcomes, and we're starting to see that as well. And like I said before, Megan and Dan have worked very closely together over the last 12 months to understand how we want to pursue our strategies in setting retail fuel prices and the outcomes that you've seen last year, and particularly in the back end. Megan's been a very big part of driving that. So, like I said before, very confident about the future.
Okay. And just following the spirit of keeping my questions in what is in your control, you turn around this coming third quarter of the Cat Cracker, which is obviously a big event for the company. You say it's going to, you know, drop about 1 to 1.5 million barrels, but could impact margins depending upon a few factors of how, you know. But my also understanding is that if you really plan this well, this CapEx should lead to an improvement of your performance at Geelong, because, you know, post the turnaround, you get an uplift in spreads because of higher quality product that become available post the turnaround. So how are you going to plan that this won't be a major disruption? Because I'd like to think that you, given the performance of Geelong in the last, you know, 6 months has been a good uplift, you should be able to go into this period by building up a bit of inventory. You've invested in tanks. So is it this won't be a major cause of concern for us, that there will be a drop-off? Yeah, the CapEx is fairly high. There's a big range of what you're going to spend, but I'm hoping that there's not going to be a material impact to your performance from this turnaround. Can you shed a bit of light on whether that's being a bit ambitious, or whether you think that you're being cautious and that if you've planned this well, there may not necessarily be an impact?
Yeah, look, these turnarounds, we do this major maintenance turnaround every 4 years, David. So it's a, you know, something we've obviously done before and we're well versed in it. We planned for these turnarounds well in advance. I mean, there was quite a lot of effort last year in planning for the turnaround this year, and obviously that will continue, but we're well placed and well prepared for it, as you would expect. There obviously is an impact during the turnaround because we're taking out a number of key units to undertake the maintenance effort, and those units will not be available to produce production, particularly in the case of the Cat Cracker. The upgrading that normally comes from that unit. We replace that lost production with imports, and again, that's all part of the planning that goes into these events. So I expect we'll, you know, I think I haven't been out and seen the work that the guys are doing in preparation, feel confident about where we're at this point in time. The range on capital just reflects the fact that when you take units down, once you're well planned for it, you may well find other aspects of the plant that need to be worked on as well. So there's always a range going into these events because you have discovery in the process. But yeah, we're well placed. We will have a disruption to production for the 2 months of the turnaround, but you know, I'm confident we'll complete that work well and restart on plan and get straight back into production at the end of the event.
In 16, was there a big drop-off in it? Because that's the last time you did such a big one. What would have been the drop-off back in 16, just to, you know, refresh our memories?
I think the way to think about it, David, is when you look back at 2016, it was a year of relatively low refining margins anyway. When we talked about our performance relative to the Singapore FCC marker in past periods, you see that there had been, I guess, a bit of a decline in our premium over the Singapore margin during the period of the turnaround. And you see that in the 2016 historical results. That's largely because the cat cracking unit, which is subject to the turnaround activities, is one of the major upgrading units. And so while there'll only be a minimal impact to intake during the period, you do experience some margin impact as a result of not being able to produce as much higher margin products during the turnaround.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Scott. Thanks, Jovan, and well done on the buyback. That's a pretty aggressive buyback. Yeah, well done on really focusing on your shareholders. So, well done.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Adam Martin from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Morning. Can we just update on the Alliance volumes? Obviously, you've talked about 65 million litres per week average. Is that sort of growing during the quarter? And also, you know, your thoughts on how close you are to the 70 in 2020, please.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks for the question. We haven't disclosed how sales have progressed since the close of the year, so obviously the results we've reported here reflect 2019. You may recall that we plan to do quarterly updates on trading performance, so we'll have an update on first quarter trading when we come out probably in April to report on that. So we'll have more to say on retail sales at that point in time, Adam. I think for now, look, I think, you know, we obviously finished the second half at an average of just under 65 million litres a week. That was consistent through the half, taking account of the normal variability you get around school holidays and things. So what we do feel confident in saying is that was a sort of sustainable level of sales as we finished exiting last year, and we hope to build on that through the course of this year and make further steps towards our mid-term goal of getting above 70 million litres a week.
Okay, well, it's local. There's been some concern in the market just regarding sort of further, you know, exposure or expansion into refining, you know, if an asset, you know, is to come up for sale. Is that, obviously refining has been a pretty difficult business since you've listed. What's your sort of appetite to expand in refining versus other assets, you know, i.e. retail or commercial, please?
Yeah, Adam, I think in terms of portfolio activities, whether it be potential acquisitions or divestments, we won't get into the habit of ruling anything in or out or making comments on that. But I think what I would say generally around potential acquisitions is that we've been pretty cautious. We've only made two in the time that we've been Viva Energy, which has been largely in the retail space, and Liberty obviously being a significant one for us, which we completed the full acquisition of last year. We are, as I mentioned in the introduction, pretty focused on ensuring that if we were to acquire that, it's, you know, adds quality earnings to our business, that it takes account of, you know, our strategy and consistent with where we're heading, and obviously is accretive to shareholders. So, and that's kind of how we look at things. Yes, there's obviously a fair bit of speculation at play around potential portfolio activities around the country, but our main focus really is on running our current business. And leveraging, obviously, the platforms we put in place in the case of our retail business, and continue to maintain momentum on running our refinery well and completing our turnaround well this year, and improving the quality of our earnings in our commercial business. That's where we see the greatest opportunity at the moment, and we're very focused on that, but we'll obviously keep an eye in terms of what's happening across the rest of industry.
Okay, that's good to hear. And just final question, just around refining, obviously crude premiums going up during the last part of the year and also the freight costs. Can you sort of, what are you seeing in January, February for both crude premiums and freight costs, please?
I think just generally around crew premiums, I think what we have seen through the transition to IMO, and there's been some commentary on it, is that the level of marine diesel that has been required to help manage the transition to IMO globally has been lower than expected. So there's been a very high demand for low sulfur fuel oil, as you would expect, but most of that production has come from fuel oil streams rather than necessarily through the addition of diesel to deliver the low sulfur limits. And so that hasn't really lifted diesel cracks as much as we would expect, but it has lifted the demand for light sweet crudes, which are obviously part of the diet for our refinery and other refineries in the region as well. So we're seeing higher crude premiums, which were partly expected, but we haven't really benefited from the same level of uplift in mill distillate cracks as we were hoping for as well. So that's what's really weighed on refining margins more recently, through the back end of last year and early this year. And I think generally, yeah, we're still very much in a period of transition. It's got some time to really bed down and get back to sort of a normal long-term operating level in terms of how the refining industry in the region's performing. So we need to give it some more time and see where it levels out. And as I mentioned in my introduction, you know, our main focus in this environment is just to really try and make the right calls around the crudes that we buy and the production the yields that we focus on in terms of the products that we produce to try and maximise the margin opportunities that are available to us.
Okay, thanks. That's all from me.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Sean Cousins from JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good morning. Just a question regarding the Coles volumes. Coles are talking about the first half being 64.4 million litres. You guys are saying 65 million litres or just under. Should we interpret that as the difference between the year ends, where you guys end on the 31st of December and they end the 5th of January? Is that effectively they're picking up 5 days of pretty subdued volumes? Is that the way we should think about that discrepancy?
Yeah, I think that's right, Sean. There's a bit of seasonality in volumes in the industry, and so over that period between Christmas and New Year's and early January, it's pretty quiet on the roads, and you tend to see that flow through in the volumes. And I think Coles are on a retail calendar rather than a typical financial year end like us, so they pick up a little bit more for January than we would.
Gotcha. That helps clarify. And if we think about your broader retail volumes, with petrol as somewhat of a proxy for that, while your Alliance volumes were up, your petrol volumes were broadly stable, only up 0.6%. Can you talk about what you've, effectively the volumes that you haven't done in petrol, and like what style of customers you're not providing fuel to now, and then what the impact that has on a retail EBITDA basis, please?
Is your question, Sean, going a bit more to the margin mix as we recover volume?
Very much so.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen some uplift in petrol. I think it's worth remembering that across the volume that you see in our results release, you know, sort of talking total company, and that covers both sales through the Alliance channel, but also sales through our dealer networks and other, you know, sales to independently branded retailers. At this stage, it's still pretty early days, but we're seeing the volume recovery, you know, largely across the board. Ideally for us, you know, we're able to capture more of the premium fuels market, and that will deliver, you know, an improvement in margin mix as the volume recovers. And we talked a little bit to the percentage of premium on total petrol in the slide on the volume performance and our real focus around trying to maximise that going forward.
And maybe just a couple of questions on the VVR. Why did you sell down the whole stake? Why didn't you sell down a lesser amount, particularly given the fairly modest that you ended up the year with $45 million in franking credits? You'll generate some on the back of the divestment. But why the decision to sell the whole 35.5 rather than a lesser amount, please?
Yeah, I think, Sean, when you think through our ownership in the Viva Energy REIT, you know, for all the reasons why you get comfortable selling down, you do so on the basis that you're comfortable selling out completely. And so It felt like maintaining, you know, a lesser shareholding, whether it was 20% or 15% or so, you know, wouldn't really change our position today, given that we've sold the entire stake, and making the capital available to return to shareholders felt like the right thing to do.
Finally, why are you being so generous to continue to provide management services on a cost recovery basis? I recognise there might have been an incentive there, given you had a large shareholding and you as a shareholder were better off. Is there any consideration around providing those on a more than cost recovery basis?
Yeah, the management contracts that we have in place with VVR was put in place when we brought the vehicle to market in 2016. It's got a 10-year term, so there's about 7 years remaining. And what we've said in the release, both on Friday and today, is that we intend to work constructively with Laurie and the other independent directors on, you know, those arrangements going forward.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Ben Gilbert from UBS Investment Bank. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. Just on the retail margin side of things, just interested in what you're seeing in terms of industry consolidation or rationality out there, particularly on the independent channel. And there's been a lot of talk around independents in particular probably having some more challenging economics given some of the margin compression, but the number of stores continues to tick up. I think we're sort of well over 6,500 now. Are you seeing any signs of consolidation coming through, or the independent part of the market in particular becoming a bit more rational on pricing?
Look, I mean, as I sort of commented before, Ben, it's a there's so many different factors at play in retail market margins, and obviously varies considerably from market to market as well. And that's the outcome is ultimately a combination of all the activities that all the competitors play and the competitive dynamic at play. So independents are part of that, but we're obviously part of it, as are many of the other majors as well. So I think generally. The outcome of all of that has been strengthening of margins in quarter four, and that's been pleasing and helps build confidence about, you know, the strategy that we're on to regrow sales through our core networks, and we're obviously very focused on that. In terms of broader industry consolidation, I think there's been some change in ownerships, which I touched on earlier, but I haven't seen any significant consolidation of retail networks within industry. Obviously, if bids like the EG bid for Celtics were to proceed, then that would be a significant consolidation. But obviously, all of that has to go through regulatory approval processes as well. And as we've seen in the past with BP's attempted acquisition of Woolworths, that's not always straightforward. So I think, look, it's extremely diverse marketplace, lots of different players. I think that adds to the competitive dynamic, but it does provide opportunities if you're clever at how you price and clever at how you play within markets, and that's what our focus is on.
And just thinking on the retail side, you obviously did sort of South Australia and parts of Victoria a little bit earlier in terms of the pricing reset. Could you give us a bit of an idea just around how that's tracking sort of 6 to 9 months in now, and then if it's you're seeing New South Wales and some of the other states follow that similar path in terms of trajectory of upswing around volumes?
Yeah, look, I think we're focusing now, Ben, now that we're sort of, you know, nearly a year into managing fuel pricing, just to focus on the performance of the total network and how that's travelling. And obviously we'll report on that on a quarterly basis, as we have done, and you can see the uplift that we've seen in the alliance, and it's not going to be helpful for us from a competitive point of view to get into a level of detail down at individual geography. So apologies for not being able to directly answer your question.
That's right. But presumably, intuitively, the ones you've gone earlier on would be having a stronger performance given the pricing is more embedded in those markets.
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously had a 9% uplift half on half. That's come from, in part, some of the markets that we'd already invested in, and obviously it's come also from markets that we have commenced investment in. So.
Great.
I think one thing I would remind everyone as well is not all of it. It's not the investment has not entirely been on improving the positioning of our pricing in markets. It's also been on leveraging our loyalty programs and reactivating customers, encouraging customers back. Obviously, we have been using the Flybuys program from that, but we also launched two other membership-based programs with carsales.com and also Transurban through the second half of the year, and that all helps us reach potential customers or customers that we can entice back with the offers that we now have.
And just final one for me, just around the commercial profitability. I know that there's probably a little bit of a disappointment or surprise at just some of the contraction in the second half, and you provided that guidance a little while ago. Just how you're thinking about the trajectory of commercial profitability looking forward. I think you sort of said as contracts start maturing, you get more add-ons, et cetera, so it should be more accretive to margin. Are you still feeling comfortable around that commentary?
Yeah, and commercial's obviously a collection of different businesses, and it's not all about commercial fuels. It's also about our specialty products as well. And so each sector has performed differently through the last couple of years. I think last year was particularly challenging, probably across all sectors. But I think each one, there's different opportunities as we look forward for improvement in some of those sectors. And I still feel I feel good about the customer base that we have in commercial across the board. I feel good about the sectors that we're involved in. And I think, yes, whilst it's been a softer year last year, it does come off the back of quite a strong year in 2018, and with some significant headwinds. We will be able to recover some of those costs as contracts renew, and some of those headwinds may decrease over time as well and provide opportunities to recover margin. So it's always a challenging business, but we have a strong position in a lot of sectors that will allow us to benefit from any upswing in trading conditions.
That's great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Michael Simotas from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. First one from me, maybe I can just pick up on that discussion around the commercial business. So a few moving parts, and I was just hoping we could break them apart a little bit. So you've got freight and FX, which obviously weighed on the business in the second half, as well as market margin compression. I think you said a third of your contracts came up for renewal in 2019. So rolling into 2020, could you just try and break apart for us, please, annualisation of those factors which we saw in the second half, as well as maybe a comment on how many contracts come up for renewal, as well as how many of your contracts allow you to recover some of those costs?
Hey, Michael, it's Siobhan here. Just touching on some of the impacts that we set out on the slide, probably the key impact there is the margin compression that we saw, which was primarily on contract renewals. We said that impact in 2019 was about $13 million relative to the prior year, and you could assume that those contract renewals weren't all undertaken on the 1st of January at the beginning of the year. So that would suggest a little bit of cycling in 2020. In the context of the ocean freight and the FX impacts, some of those contracts, and I've mentioned shorter term contracts when I talked to the slides, you could think of those in the context of 12 to 18 months and your ability to capture those increases depend on the environment at the time of renewal as well. Some of the impact we saw on ocean freight was pretty pronounced, particularly into the end of the year. While ocean freight in the context of IMO 2020 remains fairly volatile, it doesn't look like it's getting a lot worse than it already was.
Okay, but just on annualisation of those factors, it sounds like 2020 could be a bit worse than second half of 2019 before some of that stuff rolls off and hopefully you can recover it. Is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there's obviously a lot we can do in the context of some of the new strategic accounts that we talked to. We'll have the opportunity through some renewals in 2020 to reset the base on some of those items. And so, while base case might look like that, there's hopefully some opportunity to improve on that through the course of the year.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Second question from me on retail. Just interested in sort of developing a discussion around fourth quarter versus third quarter volumes. I mean, obviously, you put some pretty material investment into the market, saw a nice uplift, but that investment being in the market doesn't seem to have lifted volumes in the fourth quarter versus the third quarter. So what makes you confident that you can continue to grow volumes towards that 70 and then 75 million litre per week target without putting more investment in?
Yeah, I was pretty happy with the fourth quarter result, because you've got to remember it came off off a very strong campaign in the third quarter with Little Shop 2, which provided, you know, a very initial kick in terms of not just sales, but obviously getting customers back across the network. And so to be able to retain that lift that we'd had in quarter three in quarter four was actually a pretty good outcome, given we didn't repeat a similar campaign in quarter four. It was just more sustained activation of our loyalty program. So I think that, you know, I think finishing the year with having lifted the underlying performance of the Retail Alliance to a sort of sustainable 67 million litres a week was a pretty good outcome. And the rest of it will come just from being consistent with pricing, building confidence and trust with customers again, and leveraging the other elements of our offer, being our network and our brands and our convenience offer and the loyalty programs I mentioned before. That's how we'll continue to move forward in terms of restoring the capability of that that network.
Okay, I guess one surprising thing for me was Coles reported very strong C-store sales growth in your fourth quarter versus your third quarter, which suggests that traffic was pretty healthy through the network, but it just didn't seem to translate to incrementally higher fuel volumes. Was there anything sort of funny in the timing there?
Don't think so. No, I don't know if I'd read too much into that. We've always got customers that come in for fuel and shop, customers come in just for fuel and customers come for shop. They're very just different segments. One of the things that Coles did mention in their report was that they've seen quite a big uplift in tobacco, which I think was a segment that they were underperforming in, and they've improved their positioning in that, and that probably drove some of the uplift in sales that you saw in quarter four.
Yeah, okay. All right, and just the last question from me.
That's more for them to comment on, obviously.
Yeah, sure. Last question from me, just on the Liberty Wholesale business. I think it lost just under $1 million in the month that you had it on the books for. Based on the accounts that business had lodged, I was sort of thinking annualised it should do about $15 million of EBITDA. Is that a reasonable assumption for 2020, and will that be in the retail business?
Yeah, obviously we're not giving guidance forward, Michael, but you know, you're right about the final month of the year. It's worth remembering that we settled that acquisition on the 1st of December, and so there's a whole lot of work associated with the separation of the wholesale and the convenience business, as well as some day one transition adjustments, which all would have flowed through the December month. So in the context of you know, what that wholesale business is capable of earning, you know, I think, you know, ballpark, you're not far off. You should remember that when we talked about the opportunity to buy that business in the past, we'd talked about doing so at a multiple of EBITDA that was, you know, a small improvement on our trading multiple, if that gives you some context.
Yeah, okay, and it'll be in retail, right?
Yeah, that's the current intention, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Darren Leung from Macquarie Group. Please go ahead.
Morning, Tim. This is the first one from me, probably an extension on the Viva Retail resale. Can you give a bit of context in terms of the pricing, particularly relative to where the 10-year bond is sitting today? So you're looking at a 10-year bond that's about 1%. You know, dividend yield sitting at the sort of low fives. When you're looking at your comparables, a lot of them seem to be trading at a much sharper price. So almost as an extension of the question before, why is this the right time?
Yeah, I mean, I think you point out some helpful factors, Darren. You know, asset prices, particularly in the real estate sector, you know, in many respects are at all-time highs. When you think about where Viva Energy REIT has been trading, it's been trading pretty close to its peak at the moment. And you know, while you do look at the 10-year bond rate, you know, as a place to store cash, for us it's important to look at the alternative opportunity, which is buying back our own stock. And when you think about that in the context of the relatively small proportion that Viva Energy REIT was returning to us in the context of the cash distributions we were receiving, versus the ability to buy back, you know, approximately 20% of your market cap, really made sense for us to realise that stake now and look to return that money to shareholders.
Second question, just on coronavirus. So it's good that it hasn't impacted your business so far. Obviously, everyone's got a view on whether this thing progresses or not, but in terms of the thought process behind how it impacts your business, if it does, can you give us just a basic framework as to which parts of the commercial business it impacts and which parts of the retail business it impacts, please?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, obviously, the immediate impact is in our aviation business because, as you know, there's a significant reduction in flights in and out of Australia, and that's relatively material for the aviation companies. So, we will expect to see some reduction in jet fuel sales. We're relatively less exposed to Chinese carriers, so it's more as that starts to impact just the broader market that it will start to impact our results in aviation. But, a big part of that sector for us is domestic, obviously both in terms of major airports, but also the minor airports that we support around the country as well. So to some extent, we're insulated from the short-term impacts. I think, as I sort of touched on in my introduction, the watch point really is just the broader economic impacts if this is to be sustained and grow as a major issue, and what does that dust do for the general economy and confidence, and how does that impact our business, as it will do for every other business in Australia as well. So the short-term impact's relatively minor for now. It's more the watch point around how does this, the long-term impacts for the country.
Does they represent of your jet fuel volumes?
Sorry?
How much are the Chinese carriers as a percentage of jet fuel volumes?
Yeah, look, we won't disclose that, but we have a relatively low exposure to Chinese carriers at the moment.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you. Once again, if you wish to ask a question, please press star then one on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. Your next question comes from Grant Saligari from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Just a couple of quick ones. Just one on the off-market buyback. Just given the low franking credit balance that you have, and you've obviously disclosed the tax that you're likely to pay on the sale, I'm just struggling to see how you're going to execute a substantial proportion on the off-market buyback unless you believe there's going to be a strong capital component. Maybe you could just talk us through your thinking on that.
Yeah, sure. I guess the way to think about it, Grant, and you've called it the right way, $734 million of proceeds, after tax basis, about $680 million. Executing the return by way of an off-market buyback gives all shareholders the opportunity to participate. And while the low franking component might mean you end up with a slightly lower than typical discount to market, it's worth remembering that, we do have one large shareholder in the form of Vitol Investment Partnership who currently sit at 45% of the register. If we were to return all of the money on market, then it'd obviously be very difficult for them to participate, and we'd risk creeping them up to a control position. So, I'd expect to see them participate on a proportionate basis, and any shortfall from the broader market, then we'd be pretty comfortable returning that by way of an on-market program.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. Thanks. And just a quick one. On commercial, I guess the surprising thing to me a little is the extent of the rebase in 2019. Could you give some indication as to how much of your commercial contract volume was actually reset or recontracted in 2019? And was 2019 such a difficult year for recontracting? What were the factors that led to that?
Yeah, I think in terms of total volume, Grant, we called out previously that it was about a third of our volume that was recontracted during the year. And while it was a fairly challenging year, typically what had happened was that you'd have to give up a little bit of margin to retain those contracts in a pretty competitive environment. And so they were really the factors that led to that margin compression over the course of the year. I think
was 2019 though particularly difficult? Because could we expect that again in 2020 when you recontract another third or another quarter or whatever the proportion is?
Yeah, I think the commercial business has always been pretty competitive. We did see some pretty tough periods in terms of some of the recontracts in 2019. And there's probably a little less in 2020 up for recontract, and there'll be some opportunity for us to recover that going forward. That's obviously something we're quite focused on.
Yeah, sure. All right, thanks.
Thanks, Grant.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Wyatt for closing remarks.
Look, thanks again for joining us today to discuss the financial results of 2019. We obviously pre-guided on these last year, and pleased to say that we've finished largely in the top half of the guidance range and pretty consistent with what we'd previously announced. I guess the highlights for me, very much the strong performance of the retail business in the back end of last year, and obviously just the improvements that we made through the course of the year as well. Commercial also finished at the top end of our guidance, and as we've discussed, within commercial, a lot of different businesses and some strong positions in various sectors that provide opportunities to benefit from improvement in trading conditions going forward. And refining, a really strong year in our operating performance at Geelong, record levels of production, set us up well to continue to make the most of improvements in refining margins into the future. A lot of planning in place for a turnaround of our major units this year, and looking forward to completing that turnaround on time and in budget as well, and setting the refinery up for the next 4 years of its of operations. So overall, a lot achieved on our strategic priorities, well placed as we finish the year, and looking forward to some improvement in trading conditions this year, which will hopefully flow through to earnings through the course of the year. And of course, looking forward to continuing to maintain a strong focus on capital management and delivering on the share buyback through the course of the first half. Thanks again for joining, we'll obviously look forward to catching up with many of you through the meetings that we'll have through the course of the week. Thanks again.